Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
The Republican convention finished up recently, and of course, the presidential election is just around the corner. I chatted to political analyst and law lecturer at NUIG Galway, Larry Donnelly, where he gave us his thoughts. And first of all, he started off explaining some of the highlights of the recent Republican convention.
Republicans will point to a number of highlights. I think one of the things that was interesting was there are a number of speakers of colour who were trying, I think, in a very robust way, to dispute some of the allegations that are being made by the Democrats and by the media that Donald Trump is a racist. You had people like Tim Scott, an African-American senator from South Carolina, Nikki Haley, an Indian-American who was Donald Trump's U.S. ambassador to the UN, some ordinary Americans, African-Americans, all saying that Donald Trump was someone who they supported and someone who they did not believe was a racist and that he didn't have a racist bone in him, despite the narrative that I think is out there. I think that probably worked for him. But a lot of the other speakers, to be frank, really painted a very stark picture of what lay ahead if Donald Trump is not elected. They were really pointing to themes like lawlessness that would emerge, the underbelly of the Black Lives Matter movement, the rioting, the looting, and on the one hand, and then also saying that this was a choice between the socialism that Joe Biden would almost be pushed into by his Democratic Party and American greatness and American freedom and all the things that Donald Trump claims to stand for. So there's a really stark choice presented, and I think...
Is it fair? I mean, I know in Donald Trump's speech, Larry, he said pretty much what you're saying. He said Biden will demolish the American dream. I mean, we saw at both the Democratic and Republican conventions kind of this hysteria and a lot of obviously mudslinging and not really enough presentation of policy.
Yeah, you know, it's really extraordinary, Wendy. If we think about American politics, how much over the last 4 years have we ever talked about policy of any kind whatsoever? It's really boiled down to a discussion of Donald Trump. We don't really talk about issues so much anymore. And indeed, in the Democratic convention, it was mostly about presenting Joe Biden as a decent, honorable guy and saying, look, you can't afford another 4 years of Donald Trump in which he's free from electoral pressure and God knows what he might be capable of. So playing that fear narrative. And again, I think Republicans did the very same thing, even in even starker terms, about what America might look like in the event that Joe Biden was elected. So fear really has been the dominant theme across both of them. And of course, fear is a powerful emotion in politics. We'll just see how it plays with the American people. And I think one thing that was really different about the two was a huge focus in the Democratic convention on COVID-19 and their allegations that the Trump administration has mishandled it, whereas in the Republican convention, we heard nary a word about COVID-19.
And President Trump will probably say that it's been a victory in terms of how they've handled it. And what else was he saying in his speech then, Larry? What were the kind of key points?
He hit on the main themes. I mean, I think the speech was too long in my view, and probably, you know, optically, it probably wasn't a good idea to give it at the White House, but Donald Trump hit on all the right themes. He struck all the right notes for the vacillating Americans who are still in play. That is, he hit on the theme of, I will protect American jobs. I will put America first. I'm opposed to free trade deals. He also made the point that I'm opposed to unnecessary foreign wars. I've kept us out of those. He talked about his accomplishments in terms of appointing federal judges. He said to Democrats, especially I think the Catholic Democrats and others in the middle, that look, Joe Biden, you know, may say he's a Catholic, but his party supports a very, very late-term abortion. I think all of those issues will resonate with people. I think the one thing, again, he painted very much was this idea of rioting and lawlessness and things that could spill in from urban America into the suburbs if Joe Biden and the Democrats get a hold of things. So in terms of all of the points he'll be stressing in the months ahead, he hit all of them. So I think we know what the themes of the campaign are going to be.
Is it a dangerous road that I think probably it's fair to say, Larry, in both conventions, as well as mudslinging, there's a real tendency to focus on, rather than robust policy and that real kind of idea of what is best for the country and its citizens, but that real focus on identity politics. I guess it's an interesting thing to think about, especially when we think of John Hume's passing, and there was so much discussion on just what a peacemaker he was, and how good he was at that reconciliation piece, i.e. a total movement away from anything to do with identity politics. Yet that seems to be where so much of the focus is at the moment.
That's a really good point, Wendy. I mean, I think that unfortunately, as we've spoken about before, unfortunately the United States is a very divided and polarized country. And that division and polarization exists on numerous fronts. So while on the one hand, at both conventions, you had some platitudes about, you know, lifting America up and uniting us as Americans and all of those lofty themes, in reality, the political power play at both conventions was made on the fault lines, on those lines of division, and both parties trying to seek an advantage in terms of, you know, people's identities and which way they should vote and why they were the best candidate, depending on particular identities. I think that's a sad truth of where we are as a country in the United States. And again, I don't expect much better in the weeks and months to come. And I think that's sad.
Well, speaking of the weeks and months to come, Larry, what happens next now that the conventions are over? What are the next steps?
Well, the campaign will take off in earnest. I mean, I think that there'll be the traditional, there'll be the airwaves, the campaign ads will be flying back and forth. The candidate, now the interesting thing about this time, two interesting things. First is that COVID-19, in terms of what's expected of the candidates, you know, that 24/7 constant campaigning, big rally halls, et cetera, it's not going to be quite the same as usual. That might help Joe Biden a little bit because he probably doesn't have the stamina to do all that stuff, whereas Donald Trump, on the other hand, not only has the stamina to do it, but he's shown just how effective he can be in rallying the troops and all of that. So he thrives on that environment. So that's one element. The second thing is the mechanics of voting this time around. I mean, people are going to be voting. In just a couple of weeks, people are going to start voting for the election that begins in November. So the window, Donald Trump at the moment is behind, the window for him to get closer and closer is narrowing.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
He previously represented Ireland in the Eurovision Song Contest and is a well-known musician. Recently, I chatted to Roy Taylor about his experience with motor neuron disease and some of the fundraising efforts that he is partaking in at the moment. But Roy started off just by chatting to me a little bit about what it was first like when he was diagnosed.
It takes a little while to come to terms with it. I guess I spent about a month really dwelling on the situation and basically coming to terms with it and deciding how I'm going to go forward. And I decided two ways you can go. You can roll up in a ball or roll up your sleeves. So I said, I'm going to roll up my sleeves. I'm not going to take this line down. And from there on, I start doing things. My music has been one of my armors. And together with my son, Terence, we set up our own initiative called Watch Your Back MND. And we have written songs. We have a new song coming out in 3 weeks' time. And we've done various things to help awareness and to help fund research motor neuron.
I think it's quite inspirational, Roy, just in terms of that positive attitude of saying, well, I'm going to roll up my sleeves and try to focus on the positives. But for people who might know a lot about motor neuron disease, I think they'll find it even more inspiring when you consider just some of the impacts that it can have on you. What has been your experience of it?
Well, it is a sort of a muscle generative disease, and in some cases it can progress very fast. With other people, it can just take its time. It can also plateau. It can also just stay still. It's one of those very strange, unusual diseases, but it is pretty dark and traumatic. It can affect every muscle in your body. Like your left, one of your eyes can move, basically.
And what sort of a situation are you in at the moment, Roy? Has the disease progressed quickly?
It's relatively slow. I'm 2.5 years into it now. I cannot walk. I can stand. My arms are quite weak and my breathing is affected. So singing is very difficult. I can still talk, as you can hear. But I had to put up my tap dancing shoes for now.
That sounds like a hopeful statement from you, Roy.
Yes, indeed, because the reason why I'm talking today, Wendy, is there has never been a more optimistic time for research motor neuron. For 30 years, practically nothing has happened. And basically, you're given a diagnosis and told to go home and, as I said earlier, roll up in a ball.
And just kind of accept it and this is it and there's no care pathway for you.
Now, where there was a dark tunnel, there's a spark of light, and we're going to make that spark even brighter.
So tell us about the spark of light, Roy. What is it? it?
Well, as I said, we fund search motor neurons, and the reason I'm on today is because my great pal Pat Fogarty in Limerick, who also has motor neuron disease, has a great team down there, have come on board, and we're doing this huge classic golf event in Drumoulin Castle. And let me get back to what's happening. All the money raised is going to research motor neurons, because here in Ireland, headed by Professor Orla Hardiman, and together with about 14, 15 other countries, they have got together and they're called TRICALS, and there's no handover copybook. They're working on great things. For example, at the moment, only 10% of people with motor neuron are eligible for trials. They're going to change that to get everybody on trial. Also, there are a number of drugs, repurposed drugs, drugs that were designed for things like cancer, HIV, etc., are now retrialing them, see how they help motor neuron disease. On top of that, there's a number of new drugs coming on stream for trials. Even pharmaceutical companies are starting to get interested again. So it's wonderful. We launched last September a song called Watch Your Back, MND. We have a new song coming out 3 weeks' time called My New Dream, and the initials stand for MND. But the interesting thing is, last summer, I took it upon myself to get pneumonia, and I was in Beaumont Hospital, and there was a young girl across from me who was in a bad way, motor neuron disease. So I decided to get in my orange box and start preaching about what we're going to do, solve this problem. And little be known to me, there was a man in the corner. His name is Pat Fogarty. And sorry, got a bit emotional there.
That's okay, Roy. So anyway, you met Pat, and this kind of started the beginning of this journey for you to say, here's what we're going
to
do.
Yeah, Pat came over to me and said, I want to help. And by God, he certainly has.
He meant it. It wasn't a platitude.
Absolutely. He's behind this golf classic. It's on the 10th and the 11th in Drumoulin Castle. He's raised massive awareness. Great guy.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Every day we're hearing stories of the number of COVID-19 cases, but are we doing enough to drill down into those numbers? For example, are we focusing on the right numbers? While the numbers of COVID cases are increasing, it seems that the curve in terms of the number of ICU admissions and indeed deaths, the curve there has flattened. Well, that's something that my next guest chatted to me about earlier in the week. Ronan McGreevy, who's a journalist with the Irish Times, started off talking a little bit about why we need to talk about the numbers that matter.
So you've hit the nail on the head there, Wendy. You're talking about the numbers that matter, right? The numbers that matter are the numbers of who are dying, the numbers who are in hospitals, and the numbers who are in ICU units. And if we go back to the reasons why we had the lockdown in the first place, there were two reasons. The first reason was to save lives. The second reason was to ensure that our health services weren't overwhelmed. And by no means can you say that these figures that are at present are in any way coming close to those two scenarios. We have had in the month of August, and this is the last day, we've had more than 3,500 cases, which is worrying on one level, because we were getting to in June and July, we were getting to very low numbers on a daily basis. Now we're up to 100 plus many days. But we're not getting a huge number of deaths or hospitalizations or ICU admissions. To put it in perspective, there has only been so far this month, on my calculation, 13, maybe 14 deaths. It depends how you calculate them. During the height of the pandemic, in April of this year, there was an average of 38 people a day dying from COVID-19. So you asked me the good question, what is the reasons for that? Well, I asked the same question to a lot of people, and the reasons for it essentially are this, that the virus is now in much younger cohorts, as we know. It's in meat factories and other kind of settings like that, work settings where people are a lot younger. People who are younger are not in danger of dying or being hospitalised the way people from the elderly cohort are.
And is it a case then, Ronan, in the initial stages, you know, back in March, as you say, where, yes, you know, there was so many deaths, and obviously we know all too well, sadly, just how cases were mishandled in nursing homes, that, yes, until we got to grips with and until we understood how to better kind of protect ourselves from the virus, people that were, you know, in an older or more vulnerable age bracket were actually getting it, and obviously it was having an impact on them. Is it a case now that maybe those more vulnerable people are better protected, and therefore that's why we're seeing the death rate stay low?
Yeah, that's absolutely true, Wendy. But what's more important? This is a fact that I didn't know. Now, we all know that COVID-19 affects elderly people much worse, right? I mean, that's an established fact. But just how much worse is something that people don't know. 93% of deaths right, from COVID-19 in Ireland are for people over the age of 65, right? There's only one person in Ireland under the age of 25 who has died as a result of COVID-19. Now, that's a really important statistic. There have been 6,600 cases in people over the age of 65, right? But this, to me, is the critical figure. 6,000 of those have been in nursing homes, right? So there's just been 600 cases in the over 65s outside the nursing home setting. So that's a very, that suggests to me that this whole cocooning thing that went on in the early stages of the pandemic really worked, right? And I think that's really important to state. Once the hospitalisation started to fall very dramatically when grips was got with the COVID-19 in nursing homes. We don't have outbreaks in nursing homes anymore. Certainly not to the extent that we have. As a result of that, we're not seeing deaths and we're not seeing hospitalisation.
But is it a case then, Ronan, that, and considering the kind of figures and the statistics that you've said there, is that, you know, perhaps many people who are over 65, they are retired, and from a purely kind of economic perspective, it's that, you know, younger people they're going out to work, they're trying to get back into a sense of normality. Obviously, we've got children going back to school and all that sort of stuff, and that we have to kind of get back to some sort of balance in terms of the narrative. First of all, was flatten the curve, and now it just seems to be obsessions with the numbers every day rather than the impact that the numbers are having.
Well, I think there's a phrase for that. It's called case-demic, where you are obsessed with the numbers every day, but you don't drill down into the figures. I think one of the things that my article made clear was that at the moment, right, we can deal with the cases that we have, high and all as they are, because as we said before, people are not dying, people are not being hospitalized. The question is, though, do you get to a critical mass where eventually, you know, elderly people start being exposed to the virus because it's so prevalent in society, people start letting their guard down, and then suddenly you're back into a situation where elderly people are going to hospital and they're dying again, right? So, I mean, these things are judgment calls. They're always judgment calls on the part of any government as to what extent do you open up a country. Do you live with the virus or do you suppress it? It seems to me that, you know, once the schools opened last week, that the Irish government has basically tacitly said, even though they won't say it explicitly, that we are going to live with this virus from now on, right? We're just going to have to live with it. We're going to have to see these cases every single day. What we need to do is to try and keep it away from those people who are vulnerable to it.
Just finally to ask you, Ronan, then, just in terms of informing government policy, and obviously you're pointing to looking what's happening in other countries and even just mentioning the schools there that none have had to close again, all that sort of stuff. Is the government actually taking cognizance of what we've seen happen in other countries and indeed what we've been talking about in terms of the fact that the numbers in hospitals are actually going down, and is that informing policy enough?
Well, I hope it is, but I mean, it seems to me that we have a government that's running scared of the numbers at the moment. I mean, if you look at Stephen Donnelly made the comment last week that we were at a tipping point towards a lockdown. I mean, I don't know how he came to that conclusion based on the fact that we have so few deaths and so few admissions to hospital, right? So I would hope that the government would take this opportunity when numbers are low and when numbers are manageable to bring forward a coherent strategy. And I think it's really important that we don't panic over all of this. I mean, we're in a much, much better place than we were last March or April. So, I mean, the idea to me of a second lockdown based on the figures we have nowadays is absurd.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, both in Ireland and the UK, there's been very similar changes to how women can actually obtain abortion pills. Sadly, this change has meant that two women in the UK have already lost their lives. Earlier on in the week, I chatted to Eilish Mulroy of the Pro-Life campaign, where she explained exactly what these DIY abortions entailed and the implications they had for unborn babies and for women's health in general.
Well, basically, in the beginning of the COVID pandemic, there was our listeners will recall that there was an emergency measures bill brought in. And part of that package, even though it wasn't in the legislation itself, was to allow doctors to prescribe abortion pills to women without the pregnant woman having actually been physically examined by the doctor in question. So, in short, it's taking abortion pills at home without any kind of physical medical supervision. What happened in the UK, and the same similar, so that was brought in back in March. We don't know how many of those have happened here, but we do know for sure that around the world, certainly in England and further afield as well, massive problems have happened as a result of women taking abortion pills without proper medical supervision. The one you mentioned was in Britain. A leaked email was from one of the chief midwives in relation to this matter was discovered, was published, was broadcast in Britain, which showed that two women had died after taking these DIY home abortion pills. So that leaked email was from a senior chief midwife of the NHS.
And what happened in those situations, or do we know more about how they died?
We know a certain amount. So one woman died very quickly with sepsis while seeking urgent care at a hospital's A&E department after having taken the abortion pills. And the second woman was found dead in her home the morning after she started the home abortion process with the pills that were prescribed to her in accordance with the law of the land at the time. So those the tragedies were exposed in the UK Court of Appeal back in July when an organisation called the Christian Legal Centre was challenging the government's decision in Britain to permit DIY abortions. The reality is that many people aren't aware, and listeners may not be aware, that the same thing, the same system has been sanctioned here. We don't know if people have had these terrible difficulties and medical and physical reactions. That remains to be seen. But certainly there's always been problems with home abortions. It puts women at risk because, first of all, obviously, in Ireland, the home abortion is sanctioned where a woman is has not exceeded 12 weeks in pregnancy. But without having physically examined a woman, there's always a risk that she may be further on in her pregnancy. And in fact, in Britain, again, back in May, it was revealed that the police in Britain are investigating the death of an unborn baby after the mother took DIY home abortion pills while 28 weeks pregnant. I remember this is something that's been sanctioned, that doctors and GPs are allowed to prescribe these pills without having seen the woman. We know that an abortion always ends the life of an unborn child, but these at-home abortions are severely endanger women's lives as well.
I'm a little bit confused, Eilish, because one of my memories from the abortion referendum was that those who were pushing for abortion, one of the reasons they were saying we needed it was because they didn't want women taking these pills at home alone. Are these same advocates now saying that these DIY abortions, now they've changed their mind, that they're saying it's okay?
Well, you're absolutely right, Wendy. It was a big part of the campaign at the time of the repeal of the Eighth Amendment that we needed to have abortion to avoid women endangering their lives. And the silence is deafening from those quarters now. So there has been absolutely no comment on the deaths in England by our Minister for Health, by any of the public representatives that were busy pushing the abortion referendum back in 2018. And in fact, a number of politicians, including Eamon O'Keefe, TD, and Carol Nolan, TD, have asked parliamentary questions of the Minister for Health as to whether the Minister for Health was advised by the Chief Medical Officer to change the guidelines to allow telemedicine abortions.
And what response did they get?
The responses have been not clear. So the parliamentary questions basically haven't directly answered the question. And they're all on the record, and any of your listeners can look at those parliamentary questions on the Oireachtas website. So there's definitely a silence around this that is shocking and really alarming, given that women have died as a result of it. If any other situation where women had died and the same procedure, the same system was in place here, I think we'd be hearing a lot about it, and so we should be. I mean, remember, there's lots of things that happen with home abortions. There's lots of other, risks. For example, if a woman has an ectopic pregnancy, that's not something that can be diagnosed by a doctor remotely. And if taking home abortion pills in that scenario, that also causes grave, physical dangers. And that has happened in Britain too. So, the reality is we don't know what's happened here. We don't know how many of these home abortions have happened. The abortion legislation in this country means that we won't get those figures until next year. But I think it's an extremely dangerous situation, and you know, people should be up in arms about it. In the Pro-Life campaign, we're running a campaign this month where we're asking people to contact their TDs and senators to call on Minister Stephen Donnelly, Minister for Health, to immediately stop telemedicine abortions. Any of your listeners can participate in that, can immediately send messages to their TDs and senators by visiting the Pro-Life campaign website or Facebook page. And I think it's really important that people make their voices heard on that, because this is, we're talking about women's lives. Obviously, in an abortion, we're always talking about the death of an unborn child, but we're also talking about women's lives and health being endangered. And we're not even talking about the fact that women aren't getting any of the kind of support that they might need.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Mary's Meals is an incredible charity that feeds over 1.6 million children in some of the most impoverished countries in the world. Their aim is simple, it's to put food in the bellies of children in their place of education. Its founder, Magnus McFarlane Barr, has already written one bestseller. It's called Mary's Meals, The Shed That Fed a Million. And now he's written a second book. It's called Give, Charity and the Art of Living Generously. I spoke to Magnus earlier on in the week and he started off explaining to me a little bit about the book.
You know, I suppose that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I feel a real, in one sense, a sense of privilege, you know, all these years encountering over and over again those little acts of goodness. And as you said in your introduction, I never intended to do this work. I tried to do one small thing 30 years ago. And the reason I'm still doing it all these years later, and the reason the work has grown in this incredible way, is that outpouring of people's goodness all over the world has never let up. And yeah, as you say, I think there is a risk sometimes, those of us who lead charitable organizations, especially as they perhaps get bigger, that there's a risk of disconnection, you know, between the people we serve and those of us who work day to day, you know. And I think if our work doesn't remain rooted, absolutely rooted in a real respect for the individuals we serve, we there's real risk of going wrong, you know. And by when I talk about the people we serve, I don't only mean the children that we feed in our case, or the people that, whatever our mission might be, the people that benefit from it. I also mean you know, those who support our mission, because again, there can be a risk as we grow that they become just statistics or people that we think of in terms of marketing strategy.
But they're individuals who are you know, selflessly giving, and maybe it's the fact that you recognise that. There's one brilliant story in the book where you're just sharing the incredible generosity of one man in a nursing home who pulled his entire savings and was trying to scramble together enough to feed a child. Is it those things, Magnus, that kind of helps keep you grounded, really, in the work?
Yeah, they help keep me grounded, and they're the only reason that our work exists at all, you know. And as I say, you know, doing this kind of work, it's a privilege, isn't it? That you know, to work for charity. You know, what a boss to have. Could we have a more beautiful boss than that? But what a responsibility too. You know, to find ourselves stewards of acts of love like that one you've just described, and so many like that. It's a huge responsibility, and I do think we can't often enough remind ourselves of you know, of why our work exists and our. The values of our organization, what's our mission all about, what prompted it, what inspired it, what informs it every day. We need to think about that very deeply, I think, if we end up in as stewards, as leaders of charity.
Tell us a little bit more then about the book, Magnus. Why did you decide to write it, and what do you hope that people will get out of the book when they read it?
Well, you know, as I say, for many years I've had this privileged experience of encountering, you know, extraordinary acts of goodness, acts of love all over the world. You know, not just people giving money in the more affluent countries where we live, but also, you know, encountering startling acts of charity in, you know, amongst the poorest of the poor, you know, in the midst of the aftermath of disasters like the earthquake in Haiti. So it seems to me that this this thing in the human heart, this desire to help our neighbour when they're suffering, is a universal thing. And I think it's maybe the most beautiful aspect of humanity, you know, what sets humanity apart. I think something that points to God. When we see authentic charity, we see God. We see something bigger than that act of charity itself.
That's a really inspirational thought, Magnus, because, you know, you could look at the world in two different ways. You could look at the countries that you've been working in and see the poverty. And some people would ask the question, well, where is God in all of this? But you see God in the people.
I do, you know, and I don't, you know, I don't pretend to be able to, you know, on this interview explain the mystery of human suffering in this world created by our good, loving Father. But what I think we can see clearly is every suffering, every darkness gives us the opportunity to respond with love. We see that now more than ever, don't we, these days in the midst of this pandemic and the new sufferings, the new challenges, the new uncertainty. But within all of that, we see this new outpouring of acts of charity in our own communities, in our own streets, you know, and that's a wonderful thing. And I think that's repeated every time that human beings face a new challenge. Along with that, we see those heroic acts of love. And I think it's good to recognize that and ask ourselves, you know, where does that come from? You know, it's one of the reasons why we might say that we are created in the image and likeness of God, because it's a reflection of Him than ever, you know, for the same reasons, you know. And so while all of us, I think, have an obligation to look around us in our own communities and see the new needs and ask ourselves how we can meet them, that can't be at the expense of those poorest in the world. It can't lead us to forget about them as well. And I suppose that's what I see over and over again. The same people who love their immediate neighbours are also the people who don't forget about the poorest of the poor at a time like that. And yes, certainly, you know, one of the observations I make in the book is the people that I've met over the years who are the most charitable people, the people who've really learned to give of themselves, are invariably also the most joyful people I've met. You know, and we know that, don't we? That old truth about in giving we receive. That's not just nice words. It's true. You know, that our lives do become better. We become more fully human the more we learn. The more we learn to give. And that's something that I still feel personally very much like a beginner in that journey, but one that I'm inspired to keep, you know, persevering in.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Ireland's birth rate is currently at below replacement level. This has huge socioeconomic impacts. And of course, that's before we even talk about the lack of support for families who actually want to have more children. I spoke to Sunday Times columnist David Quinn about this earlier on the week, and he started off just reflecting a little bit about Ireland's current situation.
You'd imagine that when a society's birth rate drops below the number necessary to replace us, you'd imagine that would kind of set off alarm bells and cause there to be a bit of a national debate, because it really is a significant moment when that happens. Now, our birth rate, by the way, has been below replacement rate, which is about, you know, two children per couple. It's been below that for a few years now, but now it's beginning to slip dramatically below it. And this has all kinds of enormous implications. And of course, the number one implication is we're going to have a very rapidly aging population.
But I mean, has there even been an effort to understand there's probably obvious things. People are having children later and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, increasingly, when I'm talking to friends, and it's anecdotal, but I would imagine if thorough research is done, many people actually want to have more children, but they feel that they can't for different reasons. Whether it's, you know, financial pressures or indeed the fact that they are having children later in life. And today there was a report from a piece of research that UNICEF did, basically saying that government spending on services and tax breaks for families in Ireland was below the OECD average. So our government isn't putting in place policies that say, hey, guess what? We want to support your families, and if you want to grow them, help them grow.
Yeah, I mean, here, the only thing they ever seem to talk about is increasing the subsidy for childcare, because apparently that will make us have more children. But, I mean, that's not what's happening elsewhere in Europe. I mean, there's countries with heavily subsidised childcare, and their birth rates are also below replacement rate. What they're doing in places like Hungary is they're really now increasing the tax breaks for people who have two, three, four children, and are giving families direct help to buy cars, to buy their houses, because Hungary sees that, well, you know, the demographic implications of a rapidly aging population are absolutely huge, and it's something they've got to look at. And there's some evidence that they're beginning to have an effect in Hungary, that the birth rate's increasing. Now, it's a little bit early to say anything definitive there, because apparently in Sweden some years back they tried to do something about the birth rate, and all it did in the end was people who were going to have children anyway had them a little bit sooner. And then, you know, the whole thing flattened out again. So it just remains to be seen what happens in Hungary. But at least they're making an effort about something that is really, really important. And then places like Poland as well. Actually, what these countries have suffered from as well is, like Ireland in the past, huge outward migration. And so Ireland might be the beneficiary of that in terms of people coming here to take jobs. But it means those countries are losing their people. And so they've been hit twice over, low birth rate and losing their people. And so they're trying to do something about it.
What about, David, people who say, hang on a second, you know, world population needs to come down from a sustainability perspective?
Well, I mean, at the same time, we've been told all the time that we're moving towards decarbonising the economy and we're moving towards renewable energy. Now, if the carbon footprint of the average person begins to come down in the next 2 and 3 decades, well, that means the environmental damage caused by having more children goes down as well. But it's a very kind of, to me, a bit of a strange equation to say we'd rather have an extremely aging population. And you see, this, by the way, is ultimately it's a conversation that young people need to have, because they're the ones who'll be carrying the burden of a much older population, because obviously health costs are going to go up enormously as the number of older people increases. Pension costs are going to go up enormously for the same reason. And so all of the tax costs are going to be imposed upon younger people. And by the way, that will make it even less affordable to have children. And so we end up then in a kind of vicious circle. And of course, the answer then is we just increase the number of people that we're accepting into the country. Okay, fine. But, you know, again, if that's actually, you know, is a little bit ironic, because it says, well, we're not going to have our own children, so we'll have the children other people are having instead. All right, and so we say, we don't want to increase the birth rate because that'll, you know, cause damage to the environment, but those people over there, they're having children, so let them come in here and live instead. Well, okay, and you're kind of having it both ways then. But again, it needs to be debated.
Is that the problem then, that we're just not talking about it at all and talking about, well, what are the things that we can do to support those who want to have more children?
Well, I mean, I notice, I mean, this is just like a little bit in social media, for example, if you bring up these sort of things, they seem to think that you want to go back to an Ireland in which all women are working in the, you know, in the kitchen and all of this, and then you have this kind of very old-fashioned view of society and the segmentation of the sexes and all this sort of stuff, and so they don't want to even discuss it because they seem to think it's in some way anti-feminist, which to me is nuts, because even if you allow for the language of choice, as you were saying earlier in the item, are people actually having the number of children that they want to have? Because it turns out, I mean, there've been surveys done about this too, and it's been done by the likes of the OECD, which is an organisation of well-off countries, and they have this think tank and it's called the OECD, and you know, it asks people, how many children do you want to have? And how many children do you actually have? And the number of children that they have is almost always less than the number that's their ideal. So in Ireland, actually, what this thing showed was the number of children couples want to have is 2 or 3. And what they're having is now 2 or less.
Okay, so the research is telling us that, in other words, people do want more children. So what can we do to help them do that?
Yeah, so the first thing we need to do is we need to have a debate about it. We need to find out, well, okay, do people actually want to have more children than they're having in practice? What are the obstacles in the way? And obviously one of them would be, for example, in a place like Dublin, price of property, big long commute times. But also, you know, people are delaying getting married so long. I mean, if you're waiting until your mid to late 30s before you get married, well, then you only have a small window in which to have children. So Ireland has one of the oldest populations when we get married in Europe. And that's obviously going to be a problem as well. But we need to at least start the debate, and we need to look about the allocation of kind of public resources.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio. Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.